I'm pleased to introduce Hugh Patterson from the University of North Dakota for the third session today on assessing the difficulty of the text input task for minority languages.
Hi, can everyone hear me? Great. So let me say hello world, because that's how geeks say it, and I might be a geek. So today I want to talk and kind of start opening up a discussion in language documentation about typing, so text input, and what that means in minority languages. And one of the first things that comes to mind is, how do we compare the typing experience in one language to a typing experience in another language, when the keyboards would be very different? So those of you who are familiar with Indo-European languages in European contexts, you might be familiar that the German keyboard is quite different than the English keyboard and the French keyboard, and et cetera, et cetera. And those of you that work in a minority language somewhere else in the world, like in Africa, that uses a Roman orthography, which is where my most of my interests lie in the use of Roman orthographies, you'll know that, like the previous presenter, that there are characters that are not on the standard QWERTY keyboard. So accessing those is complex. And in today's digital environment, I'm seeing papers and discussion and where obviously digital use, like in cell phones and SMS messages and such, is quite more common than it has been in previous areas at times. So this becomes a highlighted point, right? This becomes a more salient issue in language documentation. And so I want to separate also text input from orthography. And I'm not talking about like changing orthographies so that we can do text input easier. I want to focus on just the typing task. And I want to acknowledge that the typing task is probably more complex than we've actually given it credit for, than we just sit back and take a QWERTY keyboard, change some characters, and then let's say go. It's a little bit more complex. I want to at least point that out and acknowledge that. And so then that it happened, the typing experience happens in a variety of environments and then a variety of devices. Facebook can happen on your computer or on your cell phone, right? So we have these different devices that we are also engaged with. So writing can happen on a larger keyboard or on a mobile phone of some kind. I want to also point out here that in computer science world, we talk about keyboards a little differently. We talk about that when we go to analyze a keyboard, we talk about a multi-finger keyboard where we're using multiple digits to type the message. And we also talk about a single finger keyboard, which I'll show in the next slide. But with multiple finger keyboards, we also have single character keys, right? So the key represents one character, or potentially, like early cell phones before the smartphone, right? We had T9 text predicting, and we had to hit the button multiple times to get the character we wanted. So you have this option there. Now, one thing that's not well addressed anywhere is this hold option that the iOS kind of brought forward. So you can hold a character down, and then now you get more options, right? So I'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit further in my slides. But so we talked about the T9 a little bit here. Now, one of the things that's kind of important, I think, is analogies. When we talk in digital environments, everything is usually an analogy. Like, you go to your desktop, right? This is obviously an analogy to the desktop, but the keyboard becomes an analogy as well. So QWERTY as a layout for the 10 key option is an important layout when we come to the phone, and there's absolutely no keys, there's no buttons on the phone, right? But we know where things are because of this analogy that exists in a physical world. So the power of analogies carries through into should carry back then into our design process when we're building keyboards, right? So this, even if keys are, and we have a lot of options with new technology like, smartphones with touch screens, then we have still to think about what is the analogy that we're building and what are the analogy that our language users already have in their minds so that we can create an experience that works for them in their language context. So then just the corollary to what my previous slide was here, you have single finger keyboards and multi-character keyboards. Because when you're holding your phone, right, you think about it and you're using one finger. So another dynamic of text input is that we all want it to look like something different depending on the language, right? So when I was working in Mexico, I worked with a keyboard layout for MEPPA, and it's a tone language, three tones, tone below the vowel, tone above the vowel, and mid-tones unmarked, and then a lot of glottal stops that use a sotillo. And while I was there, I also worked with Xochiapan Chinantec, and they marked the tones with numerics, stress with accents, and you can notice that this language has a lot more word breaks, right? So they use the space key a lot more. So that comes into account, what is the dance that our fingers do, right, when we're typing? So for the MEPPA text there that I previously showed, this is a heat map, and it shows the frequency of the keys, but also like where the activity is occurring, right? Another dynamic that we analyze keyboards with when we are looking at it in a computer science way or an ergonomic way is, where's the finger load, right? Are we balancing things left-handed and right-handed so that we create a nice rhythm? And then are we looking at the home row, and are we, our reach, is it up, is it down? Ergonomically, it's easier to roll in with your hands than to roll out. So where are the keys relative to what is the most frequent key, but then what came previous and what comes next? And does that then create rhythms with the hand so that they go towards the inside, which is a more natural kind of movement? In contrast, I had a larger sample of text, so we can see here that in this particular case with MEPPA, the A is used a whole lot, but then what's also used is the tone key, which is this orange key. Third key in from the right. The far right is the sotillo, and they use that a lot too. And so there's this pinky reach, and that disrupts your typing pattern when you got to think about that. But another thing that disrupts the typing pattern and a smooth pattern is that they got to think for every vowel, what is the tone? And then they go in and they go at tone mark, and then the following key is the high or low, and then so you start with the vowel. At any rate, it adds to the complexity of the situation, right? I'm not saying complexity is bad, I'm just saying what can we do that make it natural, right? So I'm not looking at the orthography, I'm saying let's let the orthography exist, and then let's look at the technical implementation of that. And so, in contrast to MEPPA, Xochiapan Chinantec uses the one and two keys at the top on the left to mark their tone, the one, two, and three, all of them, but the two and three are really popular. They have a vowel, the stressed barred I, that requires the orange key to the left of the barred I to the left of the delete key. And then the stress mark is there to the left of the return key. H is very popular. So if we look at a larger text, we can see that there's a whole lot of activity on the pinky reach. So one can easily suggest, well, maybe we should change some of these things around. And that is certainly a possibility. One of the things we need to always consider, though, is what is the context that our users are coming from? So are we in a monolingual environment? Are we in a bilingual, multilingual environment? And in both of these cases, being languages of Mexico, They have a Spanish as a LWC, right? So a language of wider communication. And their digital devices are marketed to a Spanish-speaking audience, right? So if you buy a computer in Mexico, it's going to come with a Spanish ISO keyboard layout. So that's what they're going to see. So that there's a little bit of dissonance, right, between what they see on the keyboard and what they are looking to produce in their indigenous language. So another dynamic of text input is that we do use text for different things. Some of us like comprehensive grammars, and others of us like Twitter. But text fulfills different social functions, right? And so when we're thinking about the language issues of language vitality and making a language successful in a digital medium, we got to realize that there are two different functions. And if we design our text input solution to meet a particular function, it may not take in the nature of the other functions. So if we design it just for, it's okay, we're just doing a comprehensive grammar because we're the linguist and that's our worldview, that's what we look at, then, and SMSs are really what our target audience are going to be using this language for, there's a big disconnect, and that can affect our design, and it should inform our design and how we look at text input solutions. So some assumptions about success. What would a good text input solution look like? Often with both text situations and keyboard layouts in Mexico that I worked with, I inherited the basic layout and I just adapted it to a Mac OS X environment. And there's some reasons for that. Continuity across the typing experience for the language community, regardless of what operating system you're working with. But if you can just type a language, is that good enough for language vitality? If we're going to talk about using language in digital mediums, or do we also need to allow typing without fatigue, maximize typing speed, reduce the number of typing errors? So there are computational formulas for figuring out how many typing errors we're producing. Allow rapid mastery of the touch typing method, right? So this is assuming a 10-key keyboard layout, which may not be the situation on mobile devices, right? So the conceptualizing the problem space, how can we take those assumptions and then come up with some formula that will kind of help us, guide us? The entire text input method is designed, it's analyzed with a time distance equation, right? So my fingers are going from point A to point B and it takes me so much time to do it. It's pretty simple math in that regard, but it gets a little complex when we start saying, well, what's a true error, typing error, and these kinds of things, and how do we evaluate those kinds of things? There's a really nice formula out there and a law that is in a lot of the literature about this. It's called Fitt's Law. And basically, if you start at a point, the larger your endpoint is. So if I take a stylus and I start here and I go to here, there's more area here. So I can hit anything inside of that, right? So if my target is bigger, then I get a easier transition. So in user experience design more broadly, which I'm couching keyboard layouts inside of, this becomes very important. And when we start talking about starting at character A and moving to character B, how much distance and the size of those buttons, if you're working on a mobile phone, becomes important. So I started mentioning that some people have already talked about how to analyze the efficiency of keyboards. Constable in 2001 talks about this from minority languages, but he talks about corded keystrokes. So if you're typing in a Spanish text on an American keyboard, mm-hmm. you will probably have a situation where you need to type an accent. And so you will probably need to do a key combination involving two keys. At least on the Mac OS X, that's what we use. He counts those as one, but I'm saying, well, we should probably count those as two interactions because my finger is touching the keyboard twice. So Shia and Lynn do a very nice analysis of keyboards and the frequency of keys. They only do it in English, but they only also use lowercase. So that's not usually the situation for us in minority languages. We have multiple cases, multiple punctuation. One of the best models out there that I've seen is Yin and Su, and they try to create a larger algorithm for everything. But they don't take multiple languages and compare them in situations where there are more characters than keys. So I suspect that the previous presenter here, in her language, she presented 53. So I would suspect there'd be more characters than keys in that particular situation. So defining a character is also a challenge, right? So it's easy for us in English to think about an O, but in African languages like Yoruba or Igbo, there's a variety of diacritics that can co-occur with what we might consider a Unicode-based character. So how is that taught in the language, and how does the language, the computer user, the text input user, conceive of the character? And that's not clearly defined in these previous items. So when we look at comparing across languages, can we just change the orthography to fit the keyboard? Some people have tried that, and some communities come to that conclusion rather quickly. So Berger in 2007 talks about this in the South Pacific. Cooper in Central Asia talks about it in 2005. And Yane in 2010 talks about it in Mexico. But Bailey in Africa in 2007 talks about it and says, well, we don't want to conform our orthography to the technical imperialism of computer manufacturers. So we are designing our own keyboards to fit, and they designed a keyboard for several South African languages to use. So we know that typing's hard, and the question is, can we evaluate it across languages? And when somebody comes to us in our pedagogy, when we're teaching to write in our classes, and they say, it's hard to type this language, or we work with the language community and they say, it's hard to write, what are they actually saying? Are they saying that they have a certain expectation that writing should be as easy as they perceive it to be in one language, and that this language is more difficult? Or is there something about the orthography, or is there a third option here, that there's actually something about the text input method, if they're working in a digital context, that is part of this perception? So I think I already called attention to most of these in my discussion of previous slides, but the six criteria that are in the current literature already are tapping load distribution, the number of keystrokes, hand alternation, finger posture, and hit direction, so moving from inside outside to in. What's not currently in the literature then would be perceptual distance and measuring of dissonance. So perceptual distance would be the distance that the user thinks they need to travel to get to that character. So if it's a three key combination, right, they feel like they need to make the base vowel, then they need to make a modifier key hit, and then a tone mark key hit. So there's three interactions going on there. So maybe that character seems like it's far away. Now, in some literature on languages in Mexico, they say, well, they're not marking tone. Why? Well, if it's a distance that's further away and I'm looking for speed in my output, then it makes sense to get rid of the extra distance. And so perceptual distance, I got my slides backwards. So dissonance is I think I mentioned this earlier, was the what they think versus what they see on the keyboard, right? And then perceptual distance, what I just explained. So some references, and thank you for listening. I'll take some questions.
Something we didn't even think about as we were designing our orthography, because we were thinking about input methods, and we were just like, but the fact that there are certain keys that are easier and the way your hands roll, we didn't consider any of that. And the reason was because we work with smaller minorities, smaller meaning tens of thousands, in a context where it's going to be very hard for them to sustainably support a specialized keyboard. And so we were constrained to what was available to them. And in here, you briefly brought that up when you talked about designing to the keyboard. But I think what's missing, possibly, is the fact that this social linguistic or availability of technology and technological support needs to be figured into the decision that you make when you're deciding on a keyboard and how you're going to develop it.
Sure. There is the issue of economic viability for a unique keyboard layout, right?
Who's going to install it on the machines, and where do they use it? If they use it in an internet club, they can't install the specialized keyboard there.
Well, yes and no. Internet clubs are open source packages that are quite often installed. Like, I'm taking examples from Arabic, but they, when you're, or I should say internet clubs, like in the Arabic speaking world. They do install, and the Australian National Library Association has this when they have Karen speakers in Australia. But this software is a JavaScript in-browser plugin that displays keyboards, a variety of keyboard options that people can use then right there in their communication. Browser-based, of course. Right. Now, at the OS level, take for instance Linux, that has the repository of keyboards, and SIL's NRSI commits keyboards to that repository. So if you have Linux, you can download these things, and it installs with the OS. Now, that leaves Windows and Mac. Now, Windows 8 is a lot more friendly, and they included a lot of keyboards in Windows 8, so whole internationalization on Windows 8 as opposed to Windows 7 and previous versions. Mac OS X, I would probably it has a device called Ukulele, which you can build your own keyboard and install it. So whether there's a central repository for keyboards and distribution of that to all the members of the community, that remains to be an open issue.
Yeah, that's the question, because if your end user is not technologically savvy,
sure,
but they're just a basic end user, basic texter, I think that needs to be considered in here. If you have a community where they have their own specialist in technology and who can support these things, I think that's another issue.
Well, where are they going to go get their language documentation materials? Where are they going to go get their pedagogy materials, right? This, their keyboard should be somewhere near there.
Right.
Like, perceptually near there.
When I was working on, I worked in Africa, and when I was developing, or when I was trying to teach the people I was working with, my phonologically based orthography, I was in the lucky position that there was two orthographies nationwide that you can use for SUSU, which is the lingua franca. One with where you have the E as an epsilon, the E, or you have you can write it as an E with an epsilon. And they changed it, I think, somewhere in the 80s. And they knew about these two, you know, so you could use, you know, the E with the epsilon for my transcription, and they can use the E on the phone as well, because it's French.
Sure.
In the country, and they can easily reach it. So that was easy. But this is what I'm saying, why not have several orthographies for different, we do it all the time. I do it all the time here. I'm a German speaker. I don't write the umlauts. I know the alt combinations, but I write EU for it or something like that.
Sure, you've gone Swiss.
Yeah. So, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think in our, what that's sociologically, I think that is what's happening when we look at SMS messages like across Africa, right? So when you have symbols for like an aggressive B, right? Bilabial aggressive, right? Sometimes you see them typing BB, right? On SMS messages. So I think sociologically this is happening because there isn't vendor support for these kinds of things, right? But in our position as advocates for language minorities, what is our position towards vendors? What should that be? I've seen your hand for quite a while.
Just jump right into something I was thinking about. It's like, so this topic of, we have the observation that we need JavaScript-based approaches to this, and then on the other hand, we have the problem that the mobile interfaces, as you pointed out, have a predefined interface that's not currently available to modify. So, you know, anything that we do, it has to be some sort of substitution routines to get from whatever the local standard keyboard is into what you need.
Yeah.
So, you know, you talk about the vendors. I think one thing that we might think about, and maybe this is a nutty idea, but there is a standard called the JavaScript Input Method Editor specification, and
sure,
it's not been standardized. But I think that's something that we could try to push for, so that you could define those keyboards within the web interface, and then they would be defined. You know, so you could actually define that thing that pops up at the bottom of the screen. Right now, that's off limits, effectively. I mean, without installing a keyboard, right?
With not in a computer-based, like a laptop-based, but within a mobile device, yes, I agree. But iOS 8 has the keyboard that you can use within their context. You have to develop a keyboard as a single app, which doesn't let us rapidly switch, like develop one app with multiple keyboards, right? So there is some room for growth there. I'm familiar with the Android platform. Okay.
I'm wondering if it is good to change orthography in order to feed the computer. This idea is good or not? But the example is archive orthography really do this. They used to use the lowercase v or uppercase v at the right corner of the end of the syllable.
Yeah.
But now, in order to following the computer size, they use alphabet instead of diacritic. No, I'm wondering if this is a progress or improvement.
I personally feel like we should not be slaves to the computer, that this computer should serve us. So I have a tendency to personally align more with Bailey in terms of how we should view. We shouldn't view the keyboard as a repository of possible options in our orthography, but we should look to see, okay, what are the linguistic distinctions made in the language? How are those visualized? And then let's take that problem to the computer and let's solve it.
So there's a couple of different types of issues you definitely run into with orthography. So there's certainly this type of where you're using a Latin-based alphabet with diacritics, so you have to expand the normal Latin keyboard with extra characters one way or another. But what additional challenges, or perhaps you would think would be easier, would you guess that there would be for a situation, for instance, with the Finno-Ugric languages of Russia, where the language of wider communication is Russian, they're used to using a Cyrillic keyboard, but their language is written in the Latin alphabet, so it's just a matter of, if they're texting on their phone, just hitting one button to switch the keyboard.
Right, yeah. In that kind of situation, both Android and iOS, right, they offer this button for other keyboard, right? And I think in some situations you're not going to get around, where you're in separate scripts, you're not going to get around the need for separate keyboards. Now, whether one keyboard matches phonetically to the other keyboard, that's another question. I mean, that's like your user happening to change like a sound motion kind of correspondence. I'm not sure that we have sort of data to support that, but I know that in my own work, I've happened to do that. It makes sense to me that I put a phonetic character for something in my IPA keyboard somewhere close to where that orthographic English character would be on a QWERTY. So.
One question, and then there can be time afterwards.
Sure. Go here, in the front.
I just had a question about, you made a comment about why is something hard to write? And so I wondered, I know with the orthography that I helped make for a language in Papua New Guinea, one of the reasons they chose the tilde to mark nasal vowels.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons they chose that is because to them it looked like waves, and they're a coastal people. And
sure.
So to them it was part of their identity. Later on though, when we started out with handwriting, because a lot of people don't have technology,
sure.
They have cell phones. And so when they handwrite it, it looks like waves rather than the tilde. And so I wonder if you read, and so when they go to type it now, they have to change their personal writing, which we do all the time. How I write is not how we all have personal handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But have you run into cases like that where people have been handwriting and then they get a keyboard and then that changes how they see things or what?
No, but I'd be certainly interested in citing a article that you've written about this.
We have great photos of the actual waves. Some people stick to the tilde, just as a side note to that, I just got a text from Papua New Guinea in Kala recently, and in English, how we developed how to text and type in text is very organic and has developed that way. So as a linguist coming in and saying, this should be your text orthography, this should be your booklet, you know, it has to organically develop, I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
And so people have started using apostrophes to mark the tilde because on their phones they can't do the tilde. So that's how it's organic. So just a little comment.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's lots of variation, but I would suggest that the variation is somewhat induced by perceived options of the technology, which may be real or may be not.
Okay, many thanks. The next session will start until 11, so you can still keep asking.